Welcome back. We will pick up on 273. A quick review. Remember, we've seen this whole issue of matter, meaning desire. Desire for the material world, desires of the flesh. On one hand, spirit, on the other hand. Spirit being meaning, image, the inner evolutionary spirit that guides us, and so on. They appear, at least before Jung, to operate separately. What Jung is doing is showing how they operate together. Or he's on the path to discover how they operate together. Remember, he starts with Freud. He's a Freudian at this point. So he starts with Freud's basic psychology of instinct. And really, he never departs from that. What he does is widen it to show that the instinct also contains spirit. In other words, instincts aren't just random, chaotic, unruly passions. That's certainly the way they appear, but if you know how to work with them, within them, they contain the possibility to generate guiding images to lead us. Trick is, how do you get them to do that? Well, that's what Jung is trying to figure out now. First he went to instinct, that was Salome, etc., remember, and then he goes to spirit, that was Ammonius, and then he ends up with the sun on page 272. Now that's going to be a complicated image. He says, for example, in the italicized passage, I'm drunk from the sun. One, two, three, four, five lines up from the end of that italicized passage on 272. This is just review. And on the one hand, the sun is a typical image of consciousness. Why? Because you say, I see. I'm in the light. I'm in the dark, meaning you don't know. So for Freud, that's it. There's instinct and there's consciousness. If you've ever struggled with an addiction or, you know, being out of control emotionally, the sun, i.e. consciousness, certainly seems like the goal of life. You know, if I could just get stable. So him saying I'm drunk from the sun, I think, is his still being under the spell that the highest accomplishment of life is consciousness. The problem is consciousness of what? And he's going to soon be discovering spirit. So yes, in a way, the sun is the highest accomplishment of life if it is able to discern the direction of your life.
So this, he talks about this sun as being the sun at the far bottom, the inner sun also. So this is not just consciousness.
You can see sort of a bleeding of ideas from one to the other that other points will say, well, I'm filled with the sun. And I think he's getting the idea that, or I don't know if he's getting the idea, the unconscious is throwing up thoughts that contain the idea that this light is more than a light of ego consciousness. There's also a light in the unconscious. But remember, for us this is second nature, but remember he's just discovering this thing which we make so much of. And so sometimes he talks about the sun as something he possesses and something that makes him grand. Other times he talks about the sun as something within him radiating. He doesn't want to suck the world, he wants to radiate into the world, and uses the inner sun in that idea. Later we're going to see that what he's talking about the inner sun as the source of radiation will be the wind. The wind would be the image of the spirit. But he hasn't made that distinction yet between the sun of consciousness and the wind of the unconscious, which is at the same time a kind of a sun, meaning it's got a knowledge.
So they're conflated at this point.
At this point, they're not separate, exactly. That's how I read it, anyway. And, you know, he didn't figure this out by sitting around twiddling his thumbs, but by getting involved in these erotic situations, getting smashed in the head, and then stopping and asking what's going on. And what he eventually will come to is these experiences, if you know how to interpret the imagery within them, contain guidance. That's the spirit. Spirit is the inner guidance. So that takes us over to the mid 273. So we're going to see this idea of the sun being almost idolized, and at the same time, well, next chapter we get death as its limits are beginning to be seen. So that we stopped before the italicized passage on 273. I know that you would like to hear the tidings of he whom things have not lived, but who lived and fulfilled himself. For you are son of the earth, sucked dry by the suckling earth, that can suck nothing out of itself, but suckles only from the sun. Therefore you would like to have tidings of the sun, which shines and does not suckle. I mean, there are so many thoughts in those couple of sentences. Let's start at the end. The sun which shines and doesn't suckle, I think, would be a prefiguration of the self. That's the light of the self. He whom things have not lived, I would take to mean that if you're in touch with the self, you don't let public opinion form who you are. You don't let the demands of economic life form who you are. You don't run after definitions of success based on money, property, power, etc. It's not that they're unimportant. It's that if you're in touch with the self, they are means. They aren't ends. But when you make them ends, then things have lived you.
Could he also be talking about the old pantheism here and identification with nature?
Yes, because the other way of saying what I just said is a person who lives determined by the outer world is determined from the inside by their desires. They're at the mercy of their desires for the outer world. I mean, I really know somebody, actually, whose best friends bought a bigger house. They sold theirs and built an equally big one. See what I mean? The outer world determined their choices. They never stopped and said, we don't need a bigger house. And another way to put that is their desire for prestige manipulated them into buying another house. So that would be the pantheon.
It almost looks like he's speaking even in a broader, more historical manner also. You could look at it that way, where all of the psyche was projected onto nature.
Right.
You know, as though the cow is your... He talks about the cow enacting your mother's...
Right.
Traits.
Right. Now, there's another level here, which we're going to see slipping in now then, which is, what do we do in synchronicity but interpret the physical world? So, in that sense, we do let the outer world try to guide us. But again, this is 1914, January of 1914, and he's just wrestling with what is a healthy relationship to the demands of economic, political, and social life. Well, he says they can't control you. You should make your entry into them on your own values, another way to put it. And Sunni was saying, oh, but that outer world really does have a power, and we should submit to it, but discriminatingly. August. So this is about 7 months before the war started. And at least as I'm not no historian, but as far as I'm aware, nobody had an idea there would be a war. You know, now we're ready, anticipating war at any moment. But this was far from anybody's mind. So the fact that these blood images show up here was totally confounding to him. It would be like all of a sudden we have a civil war here or something. I mean, it was a thought that was unheard of.
And the way he describes it feels so personal to him. Not even an outer world.
Well, again, I think here is a seed of ideas he really didn't ever pick up. But at the end of his life, he said, "Here's some unfinished work of mine." This parallel between inner processes and outer events. How could it be that he dreamt of the war? And I think Carol's painting is the same thing. Like you had the snake underneath the mosque. A year in advance.
That painting sort of arrived like a foreign body, too.
Yeah. But I think that's history and the collective unconscious in your art. Like it or not.
It didn't really flow within the group of images that I was creating at that time. It was a singularity.
And I had no idea what it meant until I was brushing my teeth one morning. I thought, damn.
Well, if you hadn't told me that, I don't think I would have thought about
it. Yeah, I think it. I don't know what else it would mean.
Well, it makes sense when you say that.
Yeah. Because we think of the snake of Islam as attacking us, but it's attacking them too.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Imagine what it must be like over there.
Yeah.
You're a moderate person.
And I don't know I don't know how you read the news, but my Euro friends call me up and say, "Do you realize what's happening over there? It's like the American Revolution. It's like the French Revolution. A whole new society is trying to enter into life there with an import equal to our forming our country." We get bits of it in the news, but they talk about it much more. They're closer to it, for one thing, physically, but still, I mean, I think we do tend to, at least I kind of knew it mentally, but I didn't realize it emotionally until it was pointed out to me. So we go from the sun, and then look what he says next. You would like to hear of the Son of God who shone and gave. See, and there the sun becomes the self. Christ, as an image of the self, shines. But he puts those two in text, one after the other, I don't think fully realizing that there are two systems, the ego and the self. In the next paragraph, you would like to hear of him who was not darkened by the shadow of the earth, but illuminated it, who saw the thoughts of all and whose thoughts no one guessed, who possessed in himself the meaning of all things and whose meaning no thing could express. So that's the self, again, that illuminates the horrible aspects of life. We'll see coming up, remember in Memories, he talks about the vision of a great Arctic wave descending over Europe, and everything is frozen, but he sees a tree, and the coldness turned the grapes, or he sees an arbor, I think, and the cold turned the frozen grapes ripe.
I think you were right, wasn't it?
Was it, or was it a tree?
I think you're right.
Whatever it was, the fruit becomes ripe because of the snow. And I think what he's getting to is that there is an there is something in us that even in tragic moments can provide an understanding for getting us out of a tragedy and growing through it. And that's what the self does. That's the light of the self. And it's so paradoxical because normally we see horrible things and we say, oh, that's horrible. I may have told you, I worked with a woman once who was raped, and she dreamt 9 months after the rape she had given birth to a beautiful baby. Something of high value had come out of that horrible experience. And that's what the psyche can do to release us from the terribleness of Earth shadows.
And that was what Tina shot down saw on the battlefield, right?
Same thing. He saw Christ descend and become the earth at the Battle of Verdun. He was a medic in the trenches.
And so if you find the meaning of that tragic event, so he found it. His meaning was that World War I was the rebirth of Christ, so to speak, in material form.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the only is the low level. I mean,
yeah, but I think what is so important is that, how can I put it, the level of its appearance doesn't define its value. And of course, his works were silenced. And just a few years ago, that was reversed. Or has it even been reversed? I don't know.
By the church?
Yeah.
You think it has?
Has it been reversed?
I think, but I'm not positive.
No.
I'm going to find that out.
What is this
you're
talking about?
Pierre de Chardin, you know?
Yeah.
His works were silenced by the church.
Okay. Unless he wrote about rocks.
Yeah, he could write about rocks. No. But his theological writings were.
Okay. The level of, the level of the appearance of.
Yeah, just because it was a horrible thing, how can I put it?
The level, the manifestation of what it was trying to.
Yeah. It was a horrible context, but the revelation wasn't horrible. In fact, it's sort of like saying, I come no matter how horrible. And the earth is still sacred no matter how horrible. I mean, that's how I read it. Okay, we got through one paragraph. The solitary fled the world. He closed his eyes, plugged his ears, and buried himself in a cave within himself. But it was no use. That was Ammonius, remember? That, Jung is realizing, is the state of monasticism. It tries to solve problems by fleeing from the world. And he's going to be trying to find a solution that you can live while you're in the world. So that's why he's going to reject the spiritual traditions. The desert sucked him dry, the stone spoke his thoughts, etc., etc. Skip a little farther. Since he did not shine. See where that is? 1, 2, 3 lines up from the bottom of the first column on 273. Now again, he really hasn't quite gotten clear what that shining is. Is it an ego shining? Is it a self shining? But he's realizing there is no shining from the monastic tradition.
He's using the suck so much to over here that I just wonder if he's thinking that, you read the type of person that sucks things dry or you give.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that sucking is a little bit the Freudian language still. You know, that would be the oral stage that you're stuck in the oral stage. But I think we can extend it to mean the sort of person who's a taker and who doesn't give back in return.
I mean, that's kind of the drama queen, too.
That is definitely a drama queen.
Depending on everybody's attention and time.
Yeah.
And then
Goes. Yeah, and blames you for being tired.
Yeah. But I mean, it's kind of the projection. What is happening here?
Maybe projecting the mother onto you.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, his language is a little weird because he hasn't quite gotten these things straight. I think it's weird because he realizes there is something such as shining. He just doesn't quite know what that amounts to. So he says, he, meaning Monius, or the monastic, he was desire and not splendor, completely earth and not sun.
That can't be an ego image.
No, but he hasn't defined...
In the terms of sun.
Yeah. I'm just a couple of pages ahead of you, but I'm pretty sure we're going to see soon how these two ideas crystallize out. Because we got death, and so, what good is the sun when you're dead? And then we got the remains of earlier temples, which is where a new dispensation appears. I think he starts to get clear what the nature of the shining is. So you can see, if you think it's your ego that's shining, that's what we call today narcissism. So that he was narcissistic at this point, and probably making all sorts of mistakes, because he was inflated with the self. But on the path to realizing the difference.
And he's saying that the monastic was desire, not splendor?
Yeah, because I believe that desire catches him unawares.
And I kind of saw it as when you deny all desire in your ego life, your unconscious is sucking so much energy.
Same thing. Yeah. Look at the priests. For them, the what they were getting energy from was illicit sexual behavior.
Oh, okay.
Because their official values denied the value of sexuality. So I think that's what he means.
I mean, this is getting that confused because he avoided...
No, you're right to be confused because it is confusing. And you always have to remember that what we're dealing with here are pure unconscious thoughts. So, consciously it wouldn't make sense to say that the priest is desire-bound, but unconsciously it does make sense when you see their behavior. So that's where these thoughts are coming from. In the sex abuse, you can see that they are, in fact, full of desire, which they can't deal with, and end up taking from the earth, taking from physical experiences around them, namely young boys.
Or girls.
Or girls. Isn't it mostly boys, or is it girls too?
Girls too.
As a cynical friend of mine says, so many altar boys, so little time. But it's really what it amounts to. And it's a sad truth.
And I had thought that because of all the publicity and the some of the changes in that, but I was talking to a friend from Florida yesterday, and her daughter's parish, there's several priests there that have now been found to be, mm-hmm. and has been young boys.
Mm-hmm.
But she's got two daughters there.
Yeah, I mean, as
she
a way...
said, my daughter doesn't know what to do. I said, tell her to get the hell out of there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's tragic. I mean, on one hand, you feel outrage for the children. I also feel outrage on behalf of the priests because they're living in an impossible situation.
They are indeed.
I've seen several priests, not one of them could deal with sex. As soon as sex come up, they're out the door. I feel terrible for them. And they were decent human beings, just caught and really living, trying to live a decent life, trying to serve a higher value.
One I knew was an alcoholic. He died of alcoholism. He was a young, pretty young man. Well, Belgium is more realistic or something, but when I was looking there...
Where?
Belgium. The Franciscans, every Friday or Saturday, I can't remember which day it was, or maybe it was an old week, they had a day off, and they came in with their brown robes, and this is what I was looking at there. And they explained to me, well, that's just, you know, what they do. They have to have a day.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're realistic about it.
Mm-hmm.
They were still naive enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is the abuse in Europe as bad as it is here? I just really haven't really paid attention.
I honestly don't know, because this was like in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But it was accepted. I mean, it wasn't considered abuse. And I don't know who they were playing with, but it was a thing that was there right once a week. Now, maybe this was just Franciscans. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Their customs are a little more obvious. So. Mm-hmm.
So I don't understand. What did they do? They brought their...
They had a play day. I mean, they came in, you know, as a group of
men
in their robes. But they had a day off. So what they... It was theirs to do with their play day. And it was really meant as an outlet for them.
So
they
could
talk
and pour around and talk.
I never followed them, but it was my understanding that they all had friends.
I've been told by a couple of priests who were friends of mine, this has been many years ago, but that in Europe, that many priests had affairs, you know, women that were their romantic relationship, and everyone knew that. I mean, it was just an accepted thing that was okay for them to do over there.
Much more than here.
Ireland's a totally different story. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been really affected by the abuse, but, you know, when you look at the culture there and how ingrained people were in that Catholicism, that old... Yeah.
We really sort of got Ireland's Catholicism, and I think that's why we have the same values here. Because I know they didn't really... having a hard time there, but on the continent it just seems so different.
Yeah. We have so many people who emigrated here.
And early.
Who were Catholic.
Yeah. Irish Catholic with those curries.
Or Shandy Irish. They didn't get to have rice curries.
Okay, good. I think we can just look at the last sentence on the first couple of lines and page 273, if he would have drunk of himself, he would have drunk fire. So that's the desire in him, which he never really dealt with. So now he's getting Ammonius out of his system, is basically what's going on. The solitary went in the desert to find himself, but he did not want to find himself, rather the manifold meaning of Holy Scripture. You can suck the immensity of the small and the great into yourself, and you will become emptier and emptier, since immense fullness and immense emptiness are one and the same. He wanted to find what he needed in the outer, but you find manifold meaning only in yourself, not in things. Now, I think we got to remember, not in things, meaning, not synchronicity, meaning in letting your social milieu, your greed, your shame manipulate what you want. Like, you know, that guy who bought a house because his neighbor bought a house, never stopped and say, do we need another house, and so on.
Materialism.
Yeah, materialism and the desire, not just desire for, I think, any aspect of the world, whether it's materialism, whether it's sexuality, whatever it is.
So you find meaning in yourself, and additionally you find, if you become conscious of what projection is, then you can find meaning in matter.
Yeah, he's way before that mm-hmm. point. He's just getting straight.
He hints at it, though, here in this paragraph.
Go ahead. Do you want to read it?
He just talks about meaning lying within you.
Uh-huh. The meaning that follow one another do not right. lie in things, but lie in you.
Yes.
Who are subject to many changes insofar as you take part in life.
He doesn't draw any conclusion. He doesn't really connect the two. He just mentions that.
But you can hear hints of the other psychology that's slowly mm-hmm. developing. Yeah, that's for sure. I think we got to keep reminding ourselves what year it is. Mm-hmm. And that what he says here, like you know, you shouldn't orient yourself to the world. He's really reacting to the tendency to totally orient himself by his social position. He's got this big house by the lake, you know, and he's saying, well, I need to find more, not just more of what I've got, but more of something different. And then later he can come back and say, okay, the material world is very important as a place where we withdraw projections, but he doesn't even know what projections are at this point in the way he will later talk about them.
But it seems like, you know, from the primitive people who really were conscious or very conscious or whatever, that we had to go through all this.
Yeah.
And we become conscious and then it changes.
Right.
So that it's like you're sucked into whatever the collective stuff is.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where I'm going.
Well, you're right. It's a step. You know, let's say you're talking to if I'm working with a young person who's 19 or 20, I would tell them, find yourself in the world. Don't hold back. You want two girlfriends? Go get three. Because until you can make an investment in the world, if you try to pull back from it, you just end up like the monk. Full desire, but separate from it. And remember, we're talking about a guy who's probably living in one of the most beautiful houses in Zurich, in one of the most prime real estate areas in Zurich, with a wife who is the daughter of one of the richest guys in Switzerland. So he's already done all this stuff. Now he's trying to see what's next. And just like, you know, the Jung Institute, just to give you an idea of the real estate the man comes out of, the Jung Institute, one of the Jung Institutes, is next to his house on the Lake of Zurich. And They renovated it. Just the renovation costs were $5 million. So, you know, we're talking about a $30 million house. He raised his family by today's dollars. So he's extremely grounded in the material world. And he's saying, okay, what next? Now, I think the transition, I think we've got the basic idea. A transition occurs, which we heard before, but we'll hear again. And therefore, what happened to every desire is solitary also happened to him. The devil came to him with smooth tongue and clear reasoning and knew the right word at the right moment. He lured him to his desire. I had to appear to him as the devil, since I had accepted my darkness. I ate the earth and drank the sun, and I became a greening tree that stands alone and grows. I think that's extremely important. You know, there are plenty of people that if you simply express your own point of view, which is different from them, you will be perceived as hostile. That's what a spiritual attitude ends up with. Since it denies the earth consciously, any representative of the earth will be bad. And get ready for the projection.
And that whole image really speaks to alchemy, because when that greening was the leprousness of the metals. It was the greenness of the metals. Once that was the darkness that was accepted, and then the spring broke upon them. Mm-hmm. The blessed greenness came with what they call the leprosy of the metals.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't have studied that at this point, right?
No, I don't think so. He was just reading the Gnostics, I think, at this point.
Mm-hmm. So that's like, there you see alchemy, the images of alchemy sneaking acting
in.
Acting themselves out.
Mm-hmm. So he's given up on a purely spiritual position because it can't deal with the complexities of daily economic, political, and social life. It has to see them as the devil. And because we don't know it yet, but what he's doing is preparing a psychology that will address why we're having World War I and World War II. So his work is intimately connected with political events and trying to understand why they occur. So that's why he can't accept this position that solves the problem by denying the world and seeing it as evil. Of course it's evil. Unfortunately, it's killing a lot of people, and by saying it doesn't exist doesn't stop the killing. So he wants to honor the world and where all these horrible things are happening in order to help solve some of these problems.
So him he's referring to is Ammonius?
That's Ammonius,
oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
Remember Ammonius called him the devil?
Yeah.
And later Ammonius will be back,
right,
and calls him the devil again. I always remember in this light that if you've seen Amadeus, when Mozart's confessing all his affairs and his drinking and his whoring, and then they shoot to the priest, and the priest is just sitting there going, what do I do with this? That's what he's come to. That spiritual position can't deal with somebody who really wants to live fully and naturally lives out first instinctively.
And Susan Betts knows this man's name is the musician in the movie. And my company, he always says, why, God, why did you give Mozart, Amadeus, all that talent? When you could have given it to me.
Salieri.
Salieri,
if you ever listen to his music, he writes pretty darn good music. But he's not Mozart. Yeah.
Because this guy that's whoring around and
vulgar little fucker, basically.
Right.
told me, I heard you, I read it or somebody told me a wonderful sentence, desire breeds talent. Pardon? But no desire, no talent. I'll check. Where did I hear that?
That's from a dictionary, that was.
I'll Google it. It's probably on the net somewhere. I'll see if somebody said that. But you can't get rid of it. If you leave your desire only, you buy a bigger house because your neighbor has a bigger house. And if you get rid of it, you simply lose your capacity for being inspirational. You don't shine. You suck. See, when you talk to a moralist, if you don't, come away exhausted. Because they're sucking your energy. Since I'd accepted my darkness, I think that's okay. I ate the earth, that would be that he's already established himself in the physical world. And I drank the sun. Here I still think he's a little unclear about what the sun is. That's a little, I mean, that's arrogant. I drank the sun. Later he's going to say, the sun is in me and I serve it. Here it's I over the sun. And I became a greening tree that stands alone and grows. That's positive in the sense that it's the precondition for his creativity. We're going to see later he critiques that very statement. Because standing alone, that's the ammonious. So, but these are steps along the way.
I suppose he's alone in the sense that he has to eat that earth to look at his shadow. That's a standing alone in a sense.
Yeah, I think it's a negative alone here that he means he's cut off from events. That comes up later.
What in that paragraph in the first third paragraph on the right hand side, the succession of meanings is what I think Barbara was talking about. When he does realize it's a process.
It's a process, yeah.
Well, the footnote two down below, and that's my tree. 67. Mm-hmm. Thus my tree grew in solitude and quiet, eating the earth with roots reaching far down and drinking the sun with branches reaching high up. The solitary in my soul.
Mm-hmm.
The solitary alien guest in my soul. But my green and my flooded me, thus I wandered, following the nature of the water. All those layers of the psyche, one of them is plant.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you have to be rooted through. At once, and you have to find some way to root yourself too. Not just always running around, or running away.
Yep.
And that's why I took some that.
Yes, definitely. Well, still, I think we're going to see that's a stage. It's a step, an important step.
To me, that succession of meanings thing was that the anchorite, that had meaning at one point, but because it became a dogma, because he had seen that in his own father, once it becomes a dogma, it loses meaning. Where he's realizing now that whatever meaning you find, it has to be one that can live and grow, not one that once it's found,
yeah.
It's solid.
I like that. Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He did snatch a thing of value from the anchor. That was
the
idea of.
Yeah.
The spirit coming from below.
The spirit, and I think you can just see the anchorite in Jung going down to Balogun.
Mm-hmm.
He realized that was one part of him, but it had to exist in the context of all the other parts of him. And rather, just going down there and contemplating scripture, he goes down there and contemplates his dreams, which are a response to the world, and then writes about them and takes them back to the world. And the fact that he refused to accept an atheistic psychology. Okay, then we go to death. There's death. We should kill the lights. I'm all ears.
I was amazed if you go start at the D and go down and around and back up. It feels very much like a transformation going on in that at the beginning that sphere felt like being in the mother, you know, the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's the man there, or woman, or whatever. And then, I don't know all these other things, but then down here, there's a...
When you use... Push that little red thing.
Okay.
That looks like a green.
Well, you know, I'm looking at these phalanges, or whatever you want to call them, you know, on the bed, and this too. And it looks down here, at least in the book, like this like a Pac-Man. He's got his mouth open and he's sucking this in.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes down and then there's this winged version and then there's the back to the earth in this whatever, this worm or whatever it is. And then you go back and then it starts going back up here. And what did I get from that?
And then
you go all these kind of like ladders and back the sun was and the consciousness that came through it and then you have this new man, if you will. I don't know.
Well, you start with a serpent, you end with a man. That's for sure.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I saw it exactly the opposite.
Did you? Oh, good. Tell us.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Let's see, what did I saw it as a clockwise journey.
Show us with the pointer.
Where is it? Here.
Push the little button on the top.
This one?
Yeah.
Well, so clockwise would be better.
This way I saw it go.
Okay.
So, you know, here he is. He has that, he speaks of the lizard later on in the text, but the lizard's in his gut here.
Oh, is that what that is?
Okay. That's what it looked like to me.
Okay. Okay.
And let's see, I made some notes myself here. It seems like he goes down with his sun sign or the pattern of his face, because this is a lion's face in the sun. It's like his sun sign. Mm-hmm. And it has a lizard tail.
Oh, thank you.
In my mind, he's going down with his sun sign, Leo, on the head of a serpent.
Okay.
So it's like the pattern of his fate in the unconscious.
Okay.
And then, you know, he goes down to this inner sun. You know, he's looking for this humanized form. And he's, you know, he's in the egg here, you know. And here he's in the grave that he talks about being...
Remember, prior to that, he
says, he who sleeps in the grave of the millennia dreams a wonderful dream. He dreams a primordial ancient dream. So he's in the grave. So here he's in the grave, and also it's like a temple. And from the grave, he's in the belly of the beast.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the dark night of the soul. And but the belly of the beast turns into the eye of God here, or the
logos. You know how we talk about the winged eye being the eye of God, and the logos coming from below. That was one of the symbols they talked about with the eye of God.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of this seems like the whole thing is a transformation.
And then, you know, this golden seed at first is in this human-like figure. Let's see, how did I hook those two? It's like an egg, you know, being carried upward. Also, it had it, now it contains the laser. Then he's got the seed inside him, and then the mandala, he's bringing it upwards. So it seems to me like it sort of
goes up. Yeah. Well, that's supposedly healthier than going in class.
I don't know.
It's like sort of a night sea journey,
right?
You know, with the belly of the beast kind of thing. But that whole thing, that whole idea of you know, something golden in the belly, it's in him. Yeah, and then it's outside. It contains him,
mm-hmm.
And then the logos kicks in, and it's contained in him abstractly, and then it's contained within the self, and then he is the emissary of the self with the golden thing. You know, it's like this lizardness has been incorporated up in the self in a way. But that really sort of goes hand in hand with what a figure like this on top of the inner sun means in reality. What one has to go through.
Yeah.
It's like, well, okay.
I see. Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to go through all of this.
Yeah.
If you're going to find the meaning of that inner sun with that thing standing on top of it, and that's all the ways it can grab you, and all of the,
that's all the deaths you have to go
through. All the stuff it puts you through.
Me, anyway. Yeah.
But.
Well, either way, I think you both shed a lot of good light.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's
both.
Both.
Why not a both and?
Exactly.
Yeah. I could see it going anyway.
It's like that central figure is the terror of death associated with approaching that inner sun.
Mm-hmm.
And it can mean actual death.
The one funny part of it that I saw was when he's in the, what did you call it? The grave. Yeah.
Well, he looks a bit cheerful there.
He
doesn't.
Does. He? It looks like he's waving. Yeah. Yeah.
Made it. Down here.
Yeah, right.
That's very comfortable too. Boy,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's also seems to be a temple, a sort of a temple too.
Sometimes when you're fairly unconscious, you can't.
Yeah.
Well, those two, tools, it looks like a rectangle,
mm-hmm.
in the lower right corner, and mm-hmm. then over there's another one just like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, it's like a symbolic temple.
Okay, so that's the temple part you're talking about.
But I'm fascinated by this as a symbol of the idea behind Sophia as the pattern of our fate, because this is his sun sign. To me, this is the face of a feline, you know, and Leo is his sun sign.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And yet, this abstracted figure has like a serpent's tail.
Yeah.
What is that with that eye? Doesn't he have a snake or something?
That's wrapped around him?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's almost as though he's produced the eye of Sophia as the pattern of your fate, but it's that thing that can take you through this underworld, you know.
Say more about Sophia.
Well, remember when we studied in Aurora Consurgence, she was the pattern of your fate.
Okay.
And okay. What were some of the other attributes you assigned to that idea?
Well, yeah, and it comes through the body.
Yes. Okay. Yes, and that serpent. It's definitely related to the body.
Yeah, because it's like the seven chakras. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Usually go through the I think there's seven. Like we have.
Did you want to?
No.
Carol, what do you say? Sun sign.
Astrological sign.
So is that what he's born?
He's a Leo.
He is a Leo.
It's like there's a thing that's inside that's
I don't know, wizard and human and Christian and a whole man and, you know, it, and then a whole man and a seed and a lizard again, and then finally it's incorporated as a seed and also as something he carries. It's like, I don't know, it's not clear to me, but...
Is that like the sphere? Because that kind of looks like a scarabola
or a leg. Oh, I think it definitely looks like a human, a glyph for a human being. You mean this one?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you want to think about this. It's not exactly a lizard. It's more of a dragon because dragons are the ones that have all those legs. Not any lizard that we have.
And there are those two little temples.
Yeah, the temple.
Something like the temple thing over there.
And I thought the one in the lower left-hand corner, I mean, that could be a cocoon with some butterfly wings on that side.
To me it definitely looks like that winged eye that he referred to before, which was the Egyptian symbol too.
The either symbol would be kind of the transformation.
Well, that and that thing really looks like the Egyptian death, where their wing.
Oh, the scales.
Yeah.
Your soul had to couldn't weigh more than a feather. If it did, you'd sin and bye bye.
There was a god on either end. You showed us that one.
I think so. Yeah.
The ship and then.
What do I have it here?
The god on either end.
Yeah, I see. I think that was too far back.
Isis or Osiris.
There it is.
Yeah.
I think that's the feather. That's your soul. And they're weighing it. And that's Osiris overseeing it. I think if you're a bad boy, doggy eats your soul. Well, should I have a stretch?
Is that light in the upper part just before the head, does that signify anything at all? Or is that just part of the
that there you mean?
Paint? Yeah.
I thought that was just chipped paint.
Scuffed paint. Yeah.
Scuffed, yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I just wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Wow.
Move around and give your brain some oxygen.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, it looks like the one at the bottom with the
wings. It looks like the bottom symbol could be fate, or it could be waves.
Yeah,
like the wave for the
second one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This reminds me of one of the Peanuts cartoons where they're looking at the clouds and, you know, Lucy sees all this stuff, and then Charlie Brown says, I see a ducky in the land.
Have you heard of a book, I think it is, Interpretation of Murder? I'm reading it right now. You think I know the title, but I don't. There's a lot of Jung and, let's just say Freud in it.
Oh.
And,
Although I went to the thing on the
strange interpretations. Of course, Jung, it takes place in the United States in 1909. And Freud and Jung came from Europe together, and Freud's going to give a talk at Clark University, but they have some days in New York before that, and of course there's some murders take place and stuff.
Oh. Oh, yeah, I've heard about that.
Have you?
It's not Robbers and Babies, is it?
No, I don't think so. No, isn't that terrible? I didn't even look at that.
I read that too, not too long ago, but I can't remember what it was in that. I think I'll give going to Boston with
Corey.
I thought it was Robbers and Babies.
It could be, but I think that was it's not my book, it's somebody else's, and so I just sort of took it. And so was he then into psychology?
No, he was big on Jung, yeah. He was one of the big founders of the Jung, unofficial Jung movement in Toronto.
Oh, well, I knew. I read this novel.
Who's the other guy? Fearful Symmetry. I can't remember. Yeah, they were like pre-Sharp and Woodman and Noah.
Mm.
And they were supportive of those guys, I think. So morally supportive.
Spanner
post
in that, and his book talk about that.
Oh,
about what?
About the trip to Boston.
Now this is my novel. Mostly a novel.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a fictionalized.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But the way they, Freud comes out as the big guy, and he's the one coming, and Jung's coming over as a student. And Jung misbehaving. Going to brothels and stuff like that, which really makes me mad. Because, and at the end of the book,
I don't think that would be Davies.
Pardon?
I don't think that's Davies.
I say, no, I know what it is. I think it's a law professor from Yale. And so it's not what you expect at all when you start on it. And it just sort of intensifies, but it just, and at the end, and sometimes, I think what they said is they really found no proof of that kind of behavior from Jung.
Yeah.
So why not put it in? I don't know, because it didn't do the thing to the book.
You're talking about that movie? There's a movie about on that
TV,
their trip to the States.
Yeah. I didn't know that. Was it a documentary?
No.
Is it current?
Yeah. I can't remember. You and I talked about it at one point.
Yeah, I remember either. I just tune that stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
I got enough to worry about on my own psyche.
What do you mean, tune out anything fictionalized? Or
well, it all is what they say about Jung stuff.
Yeah, right.
Well, Freud was really quite generous to Jung, but you can sense the split starting. And I almost.
Well, I think they loved each other.
Oh, they did.
Yeah.
And it was mutual. But they did make a big point that Freud did not go back to the United States after this trip.
Oh, and yeah, he hated the States.
And he thought that everybody there was foreigners.
Oh, but he hated the States. Young ones.
Well, I think that he could not have been involved in these fictitious murders, but it did sound like a peculiar group of people would say.
That's probably true.
That and New York.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
Or strange birds.
Yeah, but it's fictionalized to be stranger still.
Uh-huh.
I remember. Gary, have you looked into the idea of emergency as it relates to archetypal?
No, but I have two teaching company courses on it, which someday I will do.
Yeah.
Okay, we get some time.
There's some author called, I think it's Joe Cambry, that writes about emergence and Jungian thought.
I know of
it. I've read it.
I'd like to just understand emergence.
Well, I didn't
scientifically. Yeah.
Yeah, it gets chaos theory and complexity theory. I just got two courses on it, the two video courses.
Hmm.
I think it's an interesting concept.
I think it's very important, Bill Bridge.
I just wondered if you had come to understand it.
I bought about, somebody brought it up in a workshop I did out of town, and I said, well, give me a list of books. And I bought every damn book he said, and I tried to read every one of them, and I had no clue what they were talking about. So that's why I got these two video courses, because teaching company tends to be a little more down to earth.
And those are the ones that they advertise a big list of different subjects available.
Yeah.
A system.
In the home yesterday, and said that
it's almost as though that
her sister, who's 94,
existential. So it has to just build that to be nothing a priori to us.
The best example I've come across, if you take 100 ants and you put them on a plate of glass with water nearby, they'll run around until they die. If you put 10,000 ants, they will figure out how to build a bridge with themselves to get to the water. So that an order comes out of chaos after a certain point, which doesn't occur in the individual, but it occurs in the group.
And that order has nothing to do with anything pre-existing.
Wow.
That's the idea.
Well, we might say that's an archetype that's manifesting.
Or instinct.
Or
there's some sort of thing within themselves.
But it's as if their brain gets computing power
by the very presence
of more of them. It's as if the brain is spread out among the individual separate entities. I don't know. This was easy to demonstrate with ants.
Well, I think they're more
organized. But see, the organization only occurs when there's enough of them.
And then they apply this emergent idea to the archetypal world and man's behavior.
Yeah.
And I really follow through on that thing.
If I have time this summer, it's on my list. And the library has them if you... I got into your library. Complexity, that's called Complexity Theory, that's called Chaos Theory. Two different courses, video courses.
We haven't, that's right. I didn't have a drink. Well, we all
Shall we reconvene?
Yeah.